You get used to the regular noises that come from the vehicle you drive the most, so you notice when you're hearing a wobble or a whine where there should be a hum. Our next guest has heard many of these over the years. Zach Edwards is the owner of Ashland Automotive, and he's our partner for a monthly segment we call the Squeaky Wheel. In this context, you are the squeaky wheel, so give us a call or email to talk about automotive issues you've had or are currently having. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. And this month, we'll start with what happens back there after we drop off the car and the keys. Hi, Zach.
Hi, good morning.
So when usually you have a pretty good idea if somebody knows what the issue is with the car, you know, whatever it is that's clanking or malfunctioning, plus the fact you got the computer codes thing. So it seems like the diagnosis part is somewhat easier than it used to be, or am I making a leap of faith here?
Well, that's the hope. Having the codes available is a huge help, obviously, and as the engineering progresses, the amount of codes available increase. But our most difficult jobs are what we call no-code symptoms, where a customer is explaining a symptom, and one of the first things we do is, you know, we do a visual inspection, maybe a road test, but then we're going to plug in and see if we can't find some evidence of an error that was recorded by the computer. And if there is no evidence of that, that's when it becomes really challenging.
So you think you know what it is, but you check the codes don't confirm or deny your diagnosis.
Right, or there's no codes.
No codes.
So, you know, there's a drivability symptom, say, and almost any type of drivability concern, meaning, you know, the car is not running smoothly for one reason or another. So maybe a non-mechanical issue, but an electrical issue, ideally would have a code stored in the computer's memory that would kind of point to the right circuit having the problem. And the reason for that is that the engineering of the cars is so sophisticated that almost anything out of norm is going to trigger a light on the dash, and then behind that light is a stored trouble code, which points the technician in the right area. But every once in a while, there's something that can slip through or a problem that can happen that doesn't fall outside of the parameters of normal, which normally is what would trigger the code, is a electrical specification that's outside of the norm. So it happens less and less nowadays. You know, in the late 90s, no-code symptoms were very, very prevalent. It was a regular occurrence, and it was very difficult for technicians to chase down some of these complicated problems. But as I mentioned before, the idea is that the more codes available, the easier it's going to become to diagnose these vehicles. But the jury's out.
So the late 90s, that would have been when computers were still in their first 10 years of use in cars. And in some car models, it would have been even maybe 5 years about by that time, right?
Yeah, so it's the universal system is called onboard diagnostics, or mm-hmm. OBD. Mm-hmm. And starting in 1996, all vehicles sold in America had to be fitted with an OBD2 universal plug. And so that plug was the same in every car. And the information that was passed through that connection was a lot more universal. Prior to 1996, they were using the system OBD1. And with the OBD1, it was not a universal plug. So every manufacturer, you know, Toyota had a plug that was different than Honda's plug. And the information available to the technician was similar but different, and very different in every car.
So basically every car you can buy in the United States now is going to have the OBD2 system hookup, all that stuff, all the codes the same.
Yes, yep. And now they're moving toward OBD3. It's been a while. They've been talking about it for at least 5 years. And if you think OBD2 has been in use for well over 20 years now, so it's been a good system. I haven't done too much research on OBD3 yet because I haven't felt like they're actually going to do it. They've been talking about it for so long.
Like USB 4?
Yeah, yeah. But having the communication be universal has been a huge bonus for independent repair shops. You know, dealerships, they only work on one type of car, and so they have all of their computerized equipment fits with that one connection. And So starting with the OBD2 in 1996, independent shops got to use that same connection. It was universal. And so the aftermarket computer interface tool manufacturers were able to offer a lot more in their diagnostic tools that they could, that they're selling to independent repair shops.
So it sounds like your business is possible because of OBD2.
Yeah, it's a lot easier for us to stay competitive and in the marketplace. Yeah.
Zach Edwards is the proprietor of Ashland Automotive, and he visits us once a month for a segment we call the Squeaky Wheel. Give us a squeak of your own. Let us know what's bothering your car or truck and what you've done to alleviate the situation. 800-838-3760 by phone. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Just thought, you mentioned the amount of codes has grown so much over the years that it's getting harder to find no-code symptoms. But off the top of your head, do you know what the number of codes is? I'm just curious if it's like 10,000, 45,000,
you know,
360, what?
I feel like I'm getting a little rusty as I do more office work and less repair work, but I think it's somewhere in the 2,000 to 2,200 code.
All right, so, but there's a lot of things then that the car is going to tell you through those codes what's going on. The computer's going to diagnose it because it has all those sensors all over the cars.
Yep.
Now, sometimes do the sensors go wacky? It seems like I've had, in fact, come to think of it, I had a another one of my car stories. Yeah, my Subaru stopped dead on the freeway in Douglas County one time because the camshaft vibration sensor had not been affixed properly by the last person to repair it.
Yeah, that would be a... And that was a no-code symptom, you said?
I think what happened was that since the sensor wasn't reading, the engine just went boo.
Okay.
And I dead-sticked it into a rest area.
Yeah, normally any sensor that dies is going to set a code because the sensor is so critical for regular operation of the vehicle that what goes hand-in-hand with a sensor being critical to the operation is a sensor being monitored. So as the computer is relying on that information, if it stops seeing that information, it's going to set a trouble code and a light. And, you know, it might not see the light because the car might just stop running immediately, but the code would still be there stored in the computer's memory. And that's a really handy and powerful feature for the technician to be able to go back in and collect the information. It's kind of like a black box on aircraft.
Yeah, the people who fixed it knew right away what the deal was, and it probably because it had that code. So on that level, then, is the diagnostic system, is the onboard computer doing some work to protect the engine? I mean, if something is horribly out of norm, if the engine's way too hot or something's way too wobbly, will it just shut the engine down in an effort to save it?
Yeah, that's a good question. There's a mode called limp-in mode, and most cars have a limp-in mode, which is a basic or a set of basic operating instructions, which will get you to a place of safety, ideally, such as off the interstate if you're having a problem on the interstate. Or some of the limitations set in limp-in mode is top speed, fuel delivery. So it will revert to a pre-programmed set of fuel delivery, meaning the stoichiometric ratio, like we talked about last time, would be a preset ratio that is not ideal but functional. So your car might smell like it's running really, really rich because it is running really, really rich, but that's better than not running at all. And so that's a really important and nice feature as well of this modern design, because they know certain sensors, if there's a problem with those sensors and they just take the sensor offline and cut it out of the equation entirely, the car can't run. And so what they do is if they see a certain problem with a critical operating sensor, then they just take it offline and replace the input that sensor would normally give with a pre-programmed set of data. And then the car can basically function at a minimal state until you can get into the repair shop. Now, sometimes people drive their cars in limp-in mode for extended periods of time, and that can become really difficult because the car then starts to adapt to being in limp-in mode. It has an adaptive capability, and those can be really difficult to chase down.
Wow. Zach Edwards, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, the Squeaky Wheel, this segment, you have a chance to ask him about things going wrong with your vehicles. 800-838-3760 to get in by phone. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. So then how do you proceed then if you get in a no-code situation? What are the kinds of things you can do to begin to get a grip on what ails the car if the car won't tell you?
The technician has to, at that point, has to really rely on his or her experience and knowledge, just general book knowledge of how the systems function in relation to each other. And so in the event of a no-code symptom, the tech's going to have to use problem-solving skills and think, you know, what are the possible things that could be going on? Maybe write all those down. It's really tough to organize your thoughts when you're in one of these situations because it's so easy to go down a rabbit hole. We call it the rabbit hole. But, you know, maybe write down the list of all the possibilities that, that he or she can think of off the top of their head, and then start disseminating those the information that they can gather and matching that up with basically theories. It's very difficult.
All right, so we're basically back to the old days. It goes gadoo 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 gadoo, and the technician has to say, "Is it gadoo 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 or gadoo 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 gadoo?"
Exactly.
It's discussions of the sound effects the cars make. A call here from Lamara in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange on the Squeaky Wheel. Hi, you there?
2002 Duramax diesel Chevy that I store in a garage over the winter months. And the temperature is probably 15 degrees warmer in there than it is outside. And the only thing I've done with it is to periodically charge the battery, like every month and a half. And I wondered if there's anything else I should be doing with it or worrying about.
All right, so the Duramax diesel stays in your garage all winter long?
It stays in a garage, yeah, for three and a half months.
Okay, we'll see what we can do about that. So he's charging the battery once every month or month and a half, and other than that, any sort of maintenance thing for essentially mothballing, in this case, a diesel for the winter?
Yeah, boy, I'm not probably the most qualified person to answer that question. I never was a diesel technician myself, and I leave the diesel work up to my experts at the shop, but I do know that what you're doing with a trickle charger hopefully is a really good idea. Diesels take a lot of energy to get to crank that engine over. Yeah. The only other thing I would worry about would be water in the fuel. And most diesels have some form of a water separator in the fuel filtration system, whether it's just the fuel filter itself or they actually have a water separator. It's always good to keep an eye on that and maintain that. And then I guess the other thing I would be concerned about is rodents. When vehicles sit a lot over the winter time, we have a lot of customers come in with that situation, and rodents tend to move in. And so I would be really proactive about trapping or whatever method you want to use to make sure that they don't move in, because once they move into a parked vehicle, it can be very difficult to get them to move back out.
All right. Thanks for the call, Lamar. Appreciate that. And best of luck with getting the diesel fired up again as we enter into the spring. It's the Squeaky Wheel, 800-838-3760 and jx@jeffnet.org. Here's Paul in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Exchange.
Good morning. I have a couple of shocking questions.
Electrical, eh?
Yep. I bought a Chevy Spark EV after Standing Rock. I was so mad at what happened. I said, no more oil. And I've run into a couple of problems with it. Once, rodents did, in fact, eat my electrical system, and I found a product called Stop the Rodent, and I haven't had any issues since then. It's comes out of Texas, and it's some kind of Tex-Mex super jalapeno pepper spray, and it seemed to actually work on that. But the issues I've got, if you remember videotapes, we used to have VHS and Betamax. Well, it seems like it's the same thing with power heads for charging cars. So the first question is there any attempt to unify what we're going to use for power heads? And then the second question is, for extending range, do you know anybody who's taken battery packs out of wrecked cars and building booster trailers. And I'll take my answers off the
booster trailer. There's an interesting concept. Thanks for that, Paul. So a couple of things on cars, electrical cars. So the charging connector, I've heard from a couple people who own electrics that it's a different charge situation depending upon the car. No standardization like with the OBD2.
Yeah, as far as I know, there is no standardization. Again, I guess I'm out of my element. I need to go back to school a little bit here before the electrical car revolution. But I do know because they're so new, there's probably a lot of changes and advancements that are going to happen. I don't know about the electrical charging stations, such as like if you use one in a municipality, if that's a universal plug or not. I don't even know, actually. We at our shop, we've wired up a panel out front, and we're going to be, in the future, we want to be able to have a charging station there, but we haven't done that yet. There's just not enough of them on the road for an independent shop to be able to invest in that technology. I don't know if we've ever, maybe one time we've had one electric vehicle, like complete electric, Nissan Leaf, mm-hmm. come into the shop, and it was for an interior problem, something on the interior or a power window or something that's basically conventional. So, yeah, I'm a little out of my element, and I'll try and do some research on that before the next show.
I was just writing down for the next time we could talk about electrical plugs. And his idea of a juice wagon is intriguing, the idea of having a battery set from a wrecked electrical car that you tow behind your EV as a secondary power supply.
Yeah, I'm sure you could just... If you were towing that battery and you had easy access to the main plug, then you could do it. The problem with that is they don't want you to have access to that plug. I mean, it can be very dangerous to be messing around with those connections.
That's a wee bit of voltage, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you know, it certainly is a deadly amount of voltage and amperage in combination. And so you would have to be extremely careful. And the manufacturers just don't want any part of the everyday driver monkeying with that type of stuff. So if you were to do something like that, I would tell you to exercise extreme caution. And I know that there's a huge amount of, there's kind of like a cult following of electric car drivers, and they get into all sorts of experimental stuff. And so there's a lot of information out there on blogs and forums. But I would just tell you to be really, really careful because that stuff can kill you.
Yeah, electricity at that level, absolutely. Just a couple seconds left to ask about any difficulties with, as long as we're talking about electrics, hybrids. I mean, does it create a greater challenge to work with a drivetrain that's got two contributing power sources to it?
A little bit. We're adjusting really nicely to the hybrids. We work on a ton of hybrids, and we have the right tools and technology to do it. It took a little, you know, some training for my technicians, continuing education, but they all feel really, really comfortable on them, and there's a safety aspect to that too. They are very dangerous if you're not informed before you go into the repair. So, and there is a little bit of extra maintenance, like you suggested, but not much.
Okay. All right. Something to talk about for next time for sure, but as we move into electrical cars to get
Thanks,
more
Jeff.
Things to talk about there. Thank you, Zach Edwards from Ashland Automotive. Always good to have you here for the squeaky wheel.